Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Summer school, once the bane of the childhood summer, a remedial program for the kids who failed the previous year, now is looked at very differently. For some, it's a welcome lifeboat, of course, but for others, it's a push forward. Coming up, we'll hear about the philosophical changes in summer school across the country. Joining us now to talk about the legislative impetus for some of the change in Ohio is Julie Carr Smythe. She's State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back to the show, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
So Ohio's third grade guarantee law goes into effect this year. This is the big year. What does the law do, first of all?
Well, first of all, it will say, it'll establish certain literacy requirements for completing and moving on from the third grade. So what we'll have to do is the teachers are being trained right now, and they've had some difficulty getting the number of teachers they need for this because it's massive.
Right.
And but they will need to bring them up to speed so that they can get out of that grade. In other words, they could, under this law, stay in third grade for up to 2 years if they're not...
The first year and then a repeat year.
Right, if they're not literate to the level that the state wants. The premise behind the law is that it is... We need to catch this early, that basically, if we're allowing kids to pass through these grades and not be at the literacy level we want, then at a later date, that's going to catch up and come back to haunt them.
The old idea that you, at first you learn to read and then after that you read to learn.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Is the test just for third graders, or are districts able to give it to their kindergarten and first graders too to make, to sort of for planning purposes?
Right. I mean, I think these kids are screened starting at a very early age now, and then they can come in and base their learning on that. I think if they pass it earlier than that, then they're done. The same way with a high school graduation. You can take that test at an earlier time, say in the 10th and 11th grade,
and then you're done.
It.
Yeah. Right. If you pass it, you're done.
Right. And that will probably allow them to focus more heavily on those kids because they really are having a difficult time. The legislature had to pass a new revision to this law to open up the teacher pool for who could prepare these kids.
Yeah, I saw that. They're making it, there's a lot more leniency in it.
Right.
Bottom line is, though, a teacher only has to have 1 year of teaching experience to qualify.
Right. And they had to do that in a sense. They were using teachers who weren't even reading certified, who presumably, if you're teaching kindergarten, first, second grade, I mean, you have some training in literacy, but you're not reading certified in the way that the law initially wanted, because they needed, they saw the volume and the intensity that.
So is it altogether clear that all these extra, all these teachers that are now being brought into this category necessarily are going to be able to do the job?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think that I think that teachers feel an awful lot of pressure. I think they always have, and particularly in these grades, these early grades, because this is when they have to clear through. So I know a lot of training is going on. I know that they're running all, you know, running many, many teachers through how are we going to do this.
Throughout the summer?
Mm-hmm. But I think that that teachers are very concerned that this will be another hurdle that they have to get the kids through. In a situation where they're under a lot of pressure in a lot of areas to meet other mandates.
Is there any estimate, any expectation yet of how many kids will fall into that repeat category? Because they'll take the test at the beginning of third grade, they'll take it again at the end of third grade, and that'll be the one that determines whether or not they are kept in the third grade or whether they move forward.
Right. And I'm sorry, I don't have that number off the top of my head. I think the concern was that it was a rising number, and that we were catching too many kids in those later elementary grades who then were not able to learn, as you say, read to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at a time right now, we're at the national level, we're adjusting a lot of our standards as a nation through this Common Core because we don't see the current testing structure as competitive globally. And so that's another impetus for this is, you know, when you look at those numbers and you see that these kids are not able to read at a certain level, we don't even know in Ohio whether that level matches a national or an international standard in terms of that. So everybody's pushing these kids at that
And that's where summer school comes in. It's not necessarily about remediation. It might be for those kids that fall into that category that don't pass the test, the third graders who don't pass the test next spring. But they're trying to be proactive now, right?
Right. It has become both an academic mandate kind of in the feelings of some. You know, this is definitely a political issue and people on the different sides differ. But I think there is some consensus that we need academically to be moving forward and getting kids educated sooner and at a higher level. The Common Core will raise standards, and nobody really knows this year when those test scores hit, everybody could be tanking. In other words, if you are getting 100% in Ohio now you're going to find out what 100% means in Ohio in terms of the 50 states. And that might, we've always had state level standards, and so now we're going to see
how our standards stack up with the rest of the country.
Correct. And then you add into that, I think the pressure is on budgetarily too, that the pressure is on to definitely shrink the amount of time kids are in public schools because that saves money. So in other words, in our most recent state budget, we saw some cost effectiveness measures that look like, oh, we're going to possibly kick kids out of even college if they're not meeting a certain standard. We're going to increase the ability of kids to be more flexible with their credits in high school. Well, a lot of that is money. You know, if I'm taking 6 years to finish college and it's a public college, this is costing the state money. If I can save money and get kids to finish in 4 years, I'm not doing that by doing anything but making that kid use his time more effectively. And that's where summer school comes in.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, want to talk about summer school, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Real quick, what kind of funding did the state provide to help the districts prepare for this?
The state budget did increase funding for the districts overall.
But that's after cuts to the districts.
Right, okay. Exactly. If you take this back to the deep, deep budget deficit that we had during the recession, the federal government came in, put some stimulus money in there to retain teachers and to help education departments as well as other areas. And we've really never entirely brought that money back through some changes in the way line items were set up. It looks pretty good for the Ohio Department of Education. It looks like we've got an 8.1% increase for rural districts, for example, poor rural districts, 15% increase for urban districts.
But again, this is on top of the cuts. So what about the reading guarantee, third grade reading guarantee? Was there any special funding put in there for that because of all these teachers require this training?
I think it's another mandate that they're going to have to find ways to fund on their own. So there is some of this is so embedded that it's difficult for us as reporters to sort of see how they might use that. But I know certainly I've heard that concern within the districts that they're going to have to find this money along with a lot of other money. And they're using the same teacher pool. It's not as if they added a whole pool of teachers, new teachers. You know, they did have that legislation that added to the pool that could be used.
Joining us now to talk about how Columbus City Schools is responding with their summer school program is Helena Dameron. She's Curriculum Leadership Director for English Language Arts at Columbus City Schools. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So, Helena, first of all, Curriculum Leadership Director, what is that? What is it? What are you in charge of curriculum for English or for, you know, teaching reading?
I'm in charge of curriculum for English and reading K through 12. I do both. We provide reading professional development and curriculum for our K through 12. And it's basically the same thing when you look at Common Core. Common Core uses the term English for K through 12.
Okay. So how has the district responded to this in terms of summer schools to the reading guarantee, the third grade reading guarantee?
Well, the first thing the district response was that we knew we needed to have a pool of trained teachers. And in order to do that and make sure that summer school was successful, we have a partnership with OSU. And during the first week of June, OSU trained our teachers in a basic framework called Literacy Collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be implementing that framework throughout our district next year. However, those teachers who would be working in summer school were also trained by OSU trainers as well as our reading recovery teacher leaders. They received professional development, and we implemented reading for K-3, and it was reading only at those grades for a total of 4 hours, 5 days a week. And we used a specific framework of the Literacy Collaborative. And we also made sure that during that framework, we were implementing Common Core expectations, the shift that teachers will now have to be able to do while they're working with our students.
So 4 hours a day for kindergartners.
It was 4 hours a day. So we made sure that we had a program or a framework that allowed for small group instruction, but also allow with what we call transitional activities. So you may be in your small group for 20 to 30 minutes, and then you would have another transitional activity for 20 minutes or so. So children were moving from small group to whole group and back and forth. During our transitional activities, we did things like word wall work. We had small key books that the kids could read independently. We had activities such as interactive writing, where they worked with the teacher to write a morning message or a message to someone else. We did reader's theater with them. So there were a lot mm-hmm. of things to break up that 4 hours. But the main part of the 4 hours was ensuring that every child receives some guided reading, small group instruction.
If you did that 4 hours in what many of us think of as that traditional classroom setting that most of us, I think, grew up with, would you get the same results as the what you just described, breaking it up in the way that you described?
Would we get this?
Yeah, if you could just have them 4 hours a day, nose to the grindstone, would that necessarily get a better result than what you're doing and breaking it up and teaching it in alternative? Maybe they don't even know they're being taught.
I think when we break it up, they feel more engaged and it's much more interactive. So they're not feeling as though it's 4 hours to the grindstone. They feel like they're actually doing some things. They're producing work. They're involved in many different parts of literacy. And that's the focus, to always keep it a literacy focus, but not make it where we traditionally may have had worksheets. We never did any worksheets. It was always a reading or writing or word work activity.
But Anne, this is one of the key issues that you're bringing up in the whole idea of going to school in the summer. And the whole movement nationally to extend either our days or our school years, which is a big push right now. We mm-hmm. want to be competitive globally as a nation, but there is a pushback from some parents who say, you know, there's a lot of pressure on these kids that those of us, like you say, of our generation who grew up with a summer break are having they're having some resistance sometimes to the idea.
Well, there's a whole organized push.
Right.
Different organizations have popped up to push against it.
Right, exactly, because there first was a group for it that was pushing and lobbying and advocating for extended school days, extended school years. And so I think that there's a debate being had on how much of a break time you need, depending on your age as a student, before, you know, it becomes a lost cause because your brain's saturated.
Helena Dameron, how has the third grade guarantee changed your summer school program?
Well, that was the main focus. It changed so that we focused mainly on just reading for K-3. That was the biggest change that we made this year, and that we actually made sure that all the activities were literacy focused and that they were engaging and that they were interactive so that the kids did not feel as though they were sitting there for 3 to 4 hours. They yeah. also were given their breakfast and their lunch during that time mm-hmm. period. But we didn't want them to feel like this was just a sit and get. They
right.
were very much involved in producing things from their literacy knowledge.
I know that math was dropped in the K through 3 summer curriculum, but what about the kids who need help in math? What about that's another really important skill.
It is a very important skill, but we wanted to focus on what we knew to support our students with this third grade guarantee.
Okay.
We didn't totally drop math.
Mm-hmm.
We still did offer math in a different classroom for our 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th graders as well.
What are you doing? Does it cost? Do the parents have to pay for this? And what are you doing to get kids into summer school? Can you force them?
We cannot force them. The elementary is free for all of our parents, and we offered bus services as well. We do, through a collaboration with Parks and Rec, offer also the breakfast and the lunch to our students.
So how is Columbus City Schools paying for this then? Someone's paying for it.
We have two ways of paying for this. The first way, with our younger students, we can pay with our title funds. We can use Title I funds to pay for the lower grade students. And then we also pay with our general fund.
So you can't force, but what percentage or how do you measure the level of participation in the summer school programs in the K-3?
With this particular year in our K-3, we had, I would say, almost a 20% increase in students who attended, and that is because we offered bus services.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That is one of the biggest impediments, is that there was no bus services. So we did offer busing this year, and that increased the number of students who were able to attend.
So by increasing it by 20% to what total?
Well, the total of students. I don't have the actual number mm-hmm. in front of me of the number of students who were served during summer school.
How are you doing outreach? I went to your website and I saw what you had on your website. How else are you doing outreach to alert parents to these opportunities?
Through our parent engagement office, we always let parents know about our summer school program. We also did a dollar to let parents know about the summer school program. Our schools promote the summer school programs, and the application actually goes home. You know, from our schools, they do this with their parent meetings, their end-of-the-year meetings, making sure parents are aware when summer school is going to start. We start in January, letting parents know.
Okay. And 20% increase, that's good. What are you shooting for next year? Do you want even more?
Well, what we're shooting for next year is every child who's on an intervention plan in regards to the third grade reading guarantee, because that's part of the law. Mm-hmm. That every one of those children would sign up for summer school.
And so still, though, the ones who may sign up may not be the ones who need it the most. There's nothing way you can't even force the ones who are being retained.
Right, and I think that all comes into communication and working with our parents.
Okay.
We also do parent meetings over the summer for our K through 3 parents.
Mm-hmm.
They come to 3 parent meetings, you know, and they are taught how to work with their students in literacy activities such as reading and writing and word work.
Okay.
So we'll start in January letting our parents know. And as part of that reading improvement plan, they are aware that their students are on that plan. And as we work with them throughout the year with that plan, we'll say summer school is a part of this plan as well.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of things right. Coming up, we're going to hear from a senior education policy analyst with the RAND Corporation who has studied these kinds of things. Helena Dameron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Helena Dameron, she's Curriculum Leadership Director of English Language Arts for Columbus City Schools. That's K through 12. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Summer school. It's not your mom or dad's summer school, a remedial summer bummer. These days, it's more like a jump forward. Coming up, we'll hear about a program in Boston that has been molded since 1998 into one of the best summer programs in the country. Still with us is Julie Carr-Smyth, State House correspondent with the Associated Press. And joining us now is Jennifer McCombs. She's a senior education policy analyst with the RAND Corporation. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you very much.
So the issue is, for summer school in general, has always been, or not summer school, but the issue, one of the biggest problems has been how much kids lose over the summer. Even if they excelled and were doing fine in the end of spring, they lose over the summer, and that's a big issue.
That's correct. The research is pretty clear that summer learning loss is a real phenomenon. And what's particularly disturbing is that sort of not all students face these average losses of about, 2 to 3 months over the summer months, that they really accumulate disproportionately to low-income students. And sort of over time, really, those cumulative losses over the summer really contribute to the achievement gap that we see by high school.
Jennifer, we're having a lot of static from your phone, I think. If you could speak, hold the phone away from your mouth a little bit more, that might help us.
Is this better?
Oh, my gosh, that's so much better.
Excellent.
You have no idea. Great. So we've known this stuff for a long time, though, haven't we?
That's right. But really, the incentives and the programs haven't been in place to really serve the large number of students who really need these types of programs.
This kind of gap, this issue is not true for all kids. Why the gap? Why are some kids taking the summer off and having a great time, goofing around, and other kids are doing the same thing, but they return to school with different levels of achievement?
I think that the issue becomes the opportunities that are available to students during the summer months. While middle and higher income students have lots of opportunities, are engaged in really meaningful opportunities that build background knowledge and content and are frequently seen with books in hand, low income students don't necessarily have the same types of opportunities during the summer in terms of the engaging camps and vacations that higher income students do.
Right, and that was something I found. I did a look at these movements across the country to extend the school day, extend the school year, and those folks who are against it oftentimes are parents in situations where they relish the idea of being with their child in the summer and enjoying some things, sending them to an outdoor camp, for example, or taking a great vacation with the family. But these are not opportunities that everyone can enjoy.
They're the ones with the posters in their yard saying, "My kid's in the reading program at the local library," kind of a thing.
Right. And, the thing is that these issues are kind of tricky because those kids are excelling and they're able to read books all summer and do that kind of thing and relax. That being said, I mean, I think a lot of the middle and upper income kids are also the ones who are taking summer school that costs money. I think those families are not necessarily letting their kids sit around all summer. They're also engaging them in trying to get ahead academically, like we were talking about earlier.
Right. Jennifer McCombs, funding is probably the primary barrier.
Absolutely. And particularly for school districts that are already cash strapped right now and are having to make cutbacks during the school year itself. Funding these summer programs is incredibly difficult because we really want these programs to be available to a lot more students than districts can really send sort of to these mandated summer programs. We want these opportunities available to lots of students and for them to be really rich opportunities that combine academics and opportunities for enrichment that many middle and higher income students have the opportunity to conduct over the summer.
Helena Dameron from Columbus City Schools said that they partnered with Ohio State University to train teachers in terms of meeting this third grade reading guarantee in Ohio. That's one way I think that they've been able to save some money. They've also partnered with a local YWCA or YMCA to provide the breakfast and lunch programs. I think from reading from your work, you're saying these kinds of collaborations are all extremely important.
I think that they're really critical. And where we see the greatest success in these types of programs programs and their longevity is where there are community partnerships around the issue. And where nonprofit organizations, you'll hear Chris Smith from Boston talk about the partnerships between nonprofits and the school district in Boston, for instance, that really can help fund and sustain these programs. Those partnerships make the programs less expensive to operate during the summer months for school districts and can really help sustain them as well.
Budget issues aren't the only thing this is a sort of a budget issue, but the issue of crowding in the school districts has become one reason
why. The class size, you mean?
Right.
Okay.
Or just there's not enough room for all the kids. And that's why out in California, for example, this all got started because they needed to have room for everybody. So it's not necessarily that on an individual level kids are getting more time, but just that the teachers are teaching year-round, and so they're rolling groups of students in, aren't they? Isn't that correct?
Jennifer?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And that's slightly different in terms of sort of thinking about the extended school year and almost having school consistently, but with different groups of kids coming in at different times. And that's absolutely right that in some school districts, crowding in facilities is truly an issue and is pushing schools to operate for longer periods of time over the school
and
year.
I think, as with anything in politics, sometimes these things take hold when there is a combination of factors like that: the academic need, the budgetary pressure, the crowding, and that is what is sort of pushing this at a national level to rethink the whole issue.
One thing I saw at Jennifer McCombs repeatedly in preparing for this was that the quality of the program depends on the quality of teachers, and that's usually expensive. We're not talking about summer programs that are like day camps and daycare centers. We're talking about some pretty serious teaching going on, although in a way that they don't realize they're getting taught.
Yeah, and I'll be one to argue that you actually don't have to disguise academics to get kids to come to these programs.
Okay.
Some of the programs that we're studying don't disguise the academics, and the kids love it. And actually, I think that it's important for students to, if we want them to be engaged in school, to not think of school as being punitive, but to really be able to engage them in content, make them realize that they're learning, and you can only do that through having really high-quality teachers. Those teachers who are with the students really make a big difference in terms of what students are able to learn and the excitement that comes from being in those classes as well. As we know, some teachers can really bring content alive and are, when they're masters of their content, really are able to push students and really help them gain. And if you're with a less effective teacher or somebody without a teaching background at all, we really don't see those benefits.
Why can't we just have that kind of teaching year-round?
Well, that's the goal, right? I mean, that's what we're all after, and everyone is trying to promote, and there are a number of education efforts for that. But in summer, we see districts being able to, because not all teachers are teaching during the summer, some districts are being able to be really selective of who they choose to teach during those summer months, and they're trying to make those choices really to maximize the benefits for kids.
The parent participation component is very important. Again, Helena Dameron from the Columbus City Schools said that parents come in for 3 days as part of their summer program to learn how to read to their kids and teach their kids to read, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And also another, it's great to be able to have parents who have strategies to use at home with students, because very often parents are interested in helping their students but may not have the capacity to do so or know exactly what to do for their children's needs. And the other piece is to really educate parents and get them involved and excited about the program to increase attendance rates of kids. So if parents think that the program is important, they know that their students are engaged, they're having fun, and that it's providing a benefit, they're more likely to send their students on a regular basis. And we know that in order for kids to gain from these programs, they have to be attending them on a regular basis.
This seems like the perennial challenge in education. It's the same group that is needing to be reached. It's those who don't have opportunities at home. They come into school, in kindergarten, and they aren't necessarily up to speed with everybody. And then by third grade, which is why Ohio is doing what it's doing, it is snowballed too much. And I think that that's where the push is coming to hold them back at that point.
Yeah, Jennifer McCombs, I remember hearing about a program in New York City. Mm-hmm. It was a very special program, but one of the components of it was that they found that there was a really strong correlation between kids who were dropping off in the summer and coming back much less prepared, and parents who themselves either were very poor readers or in some cases could not read at all.
Right, and that's not really surprising. And so it's very consistent with prior literature as well about parents' educational experiences and outcomes affecting the performance of their students as well.
So what about that? That's got to be pretty embarrassing or humiliating, or, you know, some parents might not want to have to be facing that.
I think that a challenge that a lot of schools have are engaging parents who have had potentially negative experiences with school and really being able to turn them around to see how school can be a welcoming and engaging place, not only for their students, but for parents too. And I think that that's something that we see a lot of schools work on, particularly in high poverty communities, is that parental outreach piece.
It's bringing back a memory I have at my daughter's school where they would do the literacy fairs, and you know, the parents would come with the kids, and there would be activities that would go with each book. Maybe you'd bake something to go with a certain kid's book, or you'd do a craft or something. And it was a way for the parents and kids to do that together and not feel silly.
Yeah, know? I remember my kid coming home and saying, oh, by the way, I said you'd do a Japanese meal tomorrow to go with our Japanese book. Well, Julie Carswite, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer McCombs of the RAND Corporation is going to stay with us as we continue our conversation on summer school and how it's not maybe what you thought summer school was when you were growing up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're talking about summer school. It's not your mom or dad's summer school anymore. These days, it's more like a jump forward, not a remediation. Still with us is Jennifer McCombs, Senior Education Policy Analyst with the RAND Corporation. And joining us now is Chris Smith, President and Executive Director of Boston After School and Beyond. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be with you.
After School and Beyond didn't just spring from the half shell like a Venus. This program has been molded over time since 1998 in one form or another. What has been the guiding principle?
The guiding principle is that there's more to be gained by combining school, after school, and summer strategies than there is to do them in isolation. And along with that, that we have a better chance of helping kids reach their full potential if major sectors of the community are involved, including the nonprofit sector, higher education, and even business, working with the public schools.
In Boston, more than 50% of school-aged children participate in the out-of-school programs. That's a very high number.
It is, and that's a credit to, you know, Mayor Menino launched this back in 1998 and basically opened all the public schools after the final school bell to allow nonprofits to come in and run after-school programs so that the buildings are put to better use. But we could deploy nonprofits who had a mission to serve kids in a way that was cost-effective for them and allowed them to reach kids whom they might not have been able to reach otherwise.
And I noticed that nowhere along the line, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in the development that finally ended up as the Boston After School and Beyond, it's not called care after school or after school care. It's just after school and beyond. It's not about taking care of somebody like a babysitter.
It's not just about taking care of people, but it is primarily about kids being in safe, constructive settings. Mm-hmm. I think what you've seen over the last decade, not just in Boston, but nationally, is an effort to be more intentional about the skills that young people develop in these programs And there's been lots of training within the after-school sector, often called youth development, but increasingly training that involves both school-day teachers and after-school staff so that they can surround those students at all times of the day with the kind of programs and interventions that they need.
Jennifer McCombs, what do you know about Boston and how this plays into what they've done there, how it plays into this reading readiness when fall starts, when school starts in the fall?
Right. Well, Boston's done a really nice job of combining their community-based organization resources and their school district resources around summer. And in their program, students are engaged often at CBO sites themselves in academic content taught by BPS teachers and led in these enrichment activities by the community-based organization staff. Boston has incredibly high attendance rates, average daily attendance rates in these programs, so they're very popular among students who sign up for them. And I believe that it'll be interesting to find the achievement results that come from this study.
Jonathan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Ann. First, I have a quick comment that I think the phrase summer school has this negative connotation that helps damage the shift towards year-round education. But my question is, internationally, how do other countries who are using year-round education, how do they do the scheduling? Is it a trimester system? Do they have a couple weeks in between? And how well accepted is that in those countries?
Jennifer McCombs, do you know that?
You know, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I do know that internationally we have one of the lower numbers of school days across the school year, across the calendar year, excuse me. But I'm not exactly sure how the scheduling itself is working. Chris, do you know the answer to that?
I don't know that. I mean, from what I've read, there's a mixed case in number of school days, number of school hours. You know, you often hear groups point to places like Finland, and I think they have a similar school day, but a public mandate that kids do something after school as well. So they're, at least by mandate, wrapping their arms around the entire day as a learning day that extends beyond the formal school day. But I don't know about the year itself.
I was wondering, I wanted to ask you both, how nutrition figures into this. I know that the summer program for Columbus Public Schools, they have a breakfast and a lunch component. But just beyond that, in a larger sense, how does nutrition, do we know what, if there's a correlation between the foods people eat and their learning ability?
We do know that that food insecurity is highest during the summer months for low-income populations, particularly when students are reliant on free and reduced-price meals during the summer. And so these summer programs are a way of being able to ensure that a lot of these students have proper nutrition during the summer months. And so that's seen as a real benefit. And lots of these programs not only offer free breakfast, free lunch, and then often snacks to take home at the end of the day as well.
And in practice, we're tracking that this summer along with physical activity. So some kids are wearing pedometers. We're tracking miles walked, steps taken, and parts of it that students themselves see how much they're moving.
We talked about kids not having books at home, not having access to enriching experiences. What about the technology gap? Are you seeing that as an issue, Chris?
You know, in our summer programs, we're focused more on getting kids outside, moving around, getting their hands dirty, learning about academic concepts, and having fun. So there's actually less time, at least in our summer programs, spent with technology. We do make use of technology in managing the programs, but for us, it's about kids getting to places they wouldn't otherwise get during a typical summer school setting, which often confines them to a school building.
Jennifer McCombs, any thoughts about that? Because a lot of kids, the only time they have access to a regular computer is in their school room during a regular school year.
Yeah, what we hear a lot in the different districts is that kids are facing not so much a technology gap in terms of just access to a computer, but in what they're doing with computers and technology. And so that lots of kids that are in these programs aren't using technology at home for academic purposes. So, for instance, not searching the web for content necessarily, or knowing how to use Word or PowerPoint or putting together those types of presentations, whereas they're really good at playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
So we see as a difference between how students are accessing technology and how they're able to utilize it in school settings.
Yeah, my kid could do a better PowerPoint in the fifth grade than I can. My guests are Jennifer McComb. She's a senior policy analyst for the RAND Corporation, and also Chris Smith. He's president and executive director of Boston After School and Beyond. If you have a question or comment about summer school and education, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, the last caller did mention the stigma of summer school, that it and I think probably, well, I know I grew up with it being a stigma. It was a remedial thing. Chris Smith, are you still finding that? I know you have a really high participation rate, but are there still residual vestiges, I should say, of that stigma?
You know, I think so. I must have had a bad summer experience earlier in my life, because my mental image is that of the Breakfast Club. Kids just kind of wasting time, hanging out and causing trouble. I think the last caller brought up an interesting point, which is that, you know, summer may not do it justice, because it should be a year-round strategy, and the point is well taken. For us, school might be the misnomer. It's really learning, and learning doesn't just happen in school. It can happen anywhere. And so our guiding principles are that these programs, which are run by numerous nonprofits, and about a third of the schools in the Boston Public School District are involved, they're rigorous enough to count for summer school credit. So for those who need a boost or remediation, but they're engaging enough to attract kids and families voluntarily. And that's the line we're walking. You know, it's both voluntary, but it counts.
That's an interesting issue, Jennifer McCombs, that what Chris just brought up about. It's not about school, it's about learning.
That's right. And I think that a lot of these programs that are these voluntary programs have tried to rebrand themselves. They don't necessarily call themselves summer school. They call themselves summer learning programs. Some are learning opportunities and are trying to get that message out. And I think that it's also a good way to give students positive experiences for learning that they can continue into the regular school year as well.
See, Chris Smith, yours is a collaboration, as you've mentioned a couple times, between the city and schools and nonprofits. And now I get the idea that nonprofits actually help run some of these programs. It's not just that they're throwing money at you.
They do. You know, the premise of this whole approach is that the young people need knowledge, skills, and experiences to succeed in school, college, and beyond. And those partnerships are really necessary, because no one school or one type of staff person can deliver all of that alone. So we make strategic use of partners who can personalize the learning for kids, make it more interesting, more suited to their interest. They bring their own resources to the table often. And in many cases, they provide really stunning educational settings. So, for example, there are several colleges and universities that host programs. Some of the Harbor Islands, you know, we're right on the Atlantic Ocean. Mm-hmm. So we're making good use of space in addition to the talent that comes from these nonprofits.
And does it cost the families?
It doesn't. It's free. And what you'll find in most of these, if you visit, is that there'll be paying customers, those who can afford to pay for a high-quality summer program, and those who are there because it's part of Boston Public School strategy that kids learn during the summer, and they go for free as an extension of their schooling.
If you have a question or comment, you can still give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We talked earlier about teachers and teacher training, and that the one of the biggest components of success in these summer learning programs is that the teachers are excellent. Do you find teachers want to participate in the summer school or the summer learning programs?
We do. It's voluntary for them.
Okay.
And not only do they sign up to teach during the summer, they sign up to teach on Thompson Island or on the Northeastern University campus. They're signing up for something that's very particular. And what we found, interestingly, we didn't necessarily expect this, they've developed a whole new set of professional relationships and have been able to test out new strategies that they're now incorporating into the school year. And it's worth noting, too, that they're developing really good relationships with the kids. They're both in unfamiliar settings, and they develop a new set of norms, and often that takes off and can make all the difference going back to the school year.
You said it's volunteer, but they're voluntary, but they are paid.
They are paid, correct.
Yeah, and it must be kind of exciting for them to be in a different, just like for everybody. I mean, it's fun to be someplace different.
That's part of the learning process, getting out into a new, unfamiliar environment, and then over time, making that environment an extension of your school, which is really cool.
Parental participation, we were talking about that earlier as well. It's considered a big component, but lots of parents are raising families alone. They are working often more than one job. How do they participate? How do you help parents who are really just, you know, really strapped in so many, on many levels?
Well, the main barriers tend to be the cost of a program, mm-hmm. and, you know, our philanthropic community under the banner of the Boston Opportunity Agenda has been really generous in collaboration with national funders, the National Summer Learning Association, the Wallace Foundation. So together, they've been able to pay for these positions, pay for these program slots. The other barrier tends to be transportation, mm-hmm. and the Boston Public Schools has helped with that. So with those two barriers gone, the effort becomes around making sure that kids who sign up show up.
Mm-hmm.
And Rand has been very helpful in helping us estimate that and get better at making sure that, you know, the kids who sign up in April, May, June actually come on the first day of programming in July.
Jennifer McCombs, how is Rand, how are you, as a researcher, how are you measuring success? How do you do that?
So we do it in a number of ways. So we have just started the portion of our study, which is a randomized controlled trial where students signed up for the program and were assigned to either the treatment group that is attending the program or a control group who is not. They're going about business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be comparing their academic and social and emotional outcomes over time up through at least 2016 to understand what impact these programs have on student achievement and social emotional competence. And in addition, we conduct incredibly extensive implementation studies of these programs so that we're going to be able to explain to other districts how those outcomes were achieved.
Well, Jennifer McCombs, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Jennifer McCombs, she's a senior education policy analyst for the RAND Corporation. And also Chris Smith. Chris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Ann.
You make me want to go back to summer school.
Come visit anytime.
Thank you. Chris Smith is president and executive director of Boston After School and Beyond. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you so much, Jennifer.